The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Good afternoon to everybody. It's a joy to be here with everybody today. Anyway, let's go to 1 Timothy, if you would. 1 Timothy 1 today. Let's start over there. It's Veterans Day weekend, you know. Yesterday was Veterans Day. And there was a large crowd at the Arlington National Cemetery, and there Vice President Cheney addressed the people, the audience there, in what I thought was a fairly meaningful ceremony. He placed a wreath on the site of the grave of the unknown soldier there, and there he thanked all American veterans, and he praised our current soldiers, and he said this. He reminded everyone of those who are now fighting in the caves in Afghanistan, who are fighting in the sands of the Middle East. And he continued to say this, approximately 25 million of our citizens once carried the title Marine, Soldier, Airman, Sailor, Coast Guardsman, National Guardsman, or Merchant Mariner. He says now they carry the name, the term, veteran. And he says we know them today as our neighbors, friends, colleagues, and family. And he said they make us proud to be Americans. Quite a moving ceremony. And I think if you lived at a different time in America, you certainly would be very proud. I can understand his feelings about this. But war has always played an important role in the history of mankind. Jesus said this, there would be wars and rumors of wars. And boy, that has been the case, hasn't it? According to one article in the Associated Press since 3600 B.C., the world's only known 292 cumulative years of peace, that is, adding up the weeks between wars around the world over almost 4,000 years. Think about that. In 2,400 years, there have been 14,000 wars, large and small. 3.64 billion people have been killed, and the property destroyed has been absolutely enormous. In one article I read, they compared the property that has been lost as a result of war to a belt. And the belt would be big enough to go all the way around the earth, and it would be 97 miles wide, that belt. It might fit me. Be 33 feet thick and be made of pure gold. Think about that kind of money spent on wars down through history. Been 16,500 arms races, and out of those, only 16 of those have not resulted in war. And the 16 caused economic collapse in the countries in which they had those arms races. The cost of war is enormous. In the 1988 Plain Truth magazine, they said this, the cost is rising today. During the reign of Julius Caesar, it cost $1 to kill one man. The enemy. That's kind of cheap for today, isn't it? Napoleon, by the time of his reign, it cost $2,000 a person to kill somebody. The end of World War I, it reached $17,000. In World War II, it had reached $40,000. Today it costs, because of the incredible technology we have, it costs $200,000, they estimate, to kill one person. Think about that. The destructive power is unbelievable today. If you've ever watched one of the nuclear devices go off and the implosion, the power that air is forced and pieces of glass and splinters are sent at hundreds of miles an hour flying out for miles. People's, they look at the blast, they'll blind them if they're 25 miles away. It's an amazing thing. Today, you can shoot missiles and guide them, and I've heard reports that in the Desert Storm, they watch these cruise missiles go down the street and make a turn. It's incredible, the technology we have. We can shoot missiles from underneath the sea now, and they shoot them in bundles. They shoot one giant missile that comes up off of a submarine, goes into the air, and shoots up to the edge of the atmosphere, turns, faces the target, and then releases six other missiles, and each one of those missiles can be guided with pinpoint accuracy to its target. It's just unbelievable, the power that we have in war today. President Carter, ex-President Carter, said this about nuclear war. Today, in a nuclear war, more destructive power than all of World War II would be unleashed every second during the long afternoon that it would take for all the missiles and bombs to fall. The survivors, if any, would live in despair amidst the poisoned ruins of a civilization that had committed suicide. It's amazing. He's right, though. Through all of the conflicts from the beginning of time, through all of these wars that have occurred, there's been another war, a silent war, secret war almost, a quiet war, invisible to almost everyone on earth, almost everyone. God's people from the time of Adam and Eve have been in a war, 1 Timothy 1 and verse 8. But we know it says that the law is good. I'm sorry, must be in second. Let me just check that. No. It's 18. This charge I commit unto you, son Timothy, according to the prophecies which went before on you, that you by them might war a good warfare. And so Paul shows how Timothy, the young evangelist, was warring a warfare. And the scriptures refer to the eternal God as the Lord of hosts, don't they? That word host means armies, doesn't it? So here we have Jesus Christ, the Lord of armies. Well, why use these terms if we aren't pictured as being in a kind of war? We are soldiers, and we're in a Christian fight. We are Christian soldiers, fighting a war not against other men, but we're fighting a war for other men, aren't we? The battle you and I fight is on behalf of mankind, that we can overcome and one day help Jesus Christ to solve this world's problems. So we fight for other men. What's interesting to me is this is not a war of our generation. The war we're in is a war that has been handed down to us from other generations. It has been fought for many generations. It goes back to the beginning of time, 2 Corinthians 10. Each person of God down through the ages has been involved in this battle, 2 Corinthians 10. Each one called in their generation, and we're in this war, a battle against falsehood, a battle against sin, a battle against the pulls of the world, a battle against Satan's influence, and yes, a battle against ourselves, isn't it? Against our very nature. That's what we're in a fight all about. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. Now I, Paul, myself beseech you, he says, by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, who am in your presence, I'm base among you, but being absent, I'm bold towards you. But I beseech you that I may not be bold when I'm present with that confidence wherewith I think to be bold against some, which I think of us, as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we don't war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare aren't carnal, but they're mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. Even this, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ, and having a readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is filled or fulfilled. So the weapons that we use in our war aren't carnal. That is, they aren't bows and arrows. They aren't swords. They aren't spears. They aren't nuclear weapons or missiles. But we're fighting a war that's taking place in our mind. Remember how Paul said, the thing I want to do, I don't do? There was this battle going on with him all the time. And that battle goes on with every one of us, inside our mind, the control of our mind. So we fight against these pulls that are in us. It's like 1 Peter 2. And every one of us does this. Dearly beloved, he says, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. And then 2 Timothy, if you will. The lusts of life war against us. That is, they pull on us, they intrude, and it makes life difficult. And therefore, it makes life sometimes a hardship to live. In 2 Timothy 2 and verse 3, it says, "Therefore, endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man who wars entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who has chosen him to be a soldier." How many times do you think of it like this? Do we ever think of it? We're called to be a soldier. Do we think about this? We're Christian soldiers in a spiritual battle. Do we think of it? So, we endure hardship. We don't have a lot of leisure. Sometimes we don't have a lot of money. Sometimes we don't have a lot of what the rest of the world has. Here's something we have. We have a heritage. We have a heritage that goes back, and an association, because we're links in a chain from the very beginning of the people who have fought the same fight. And we go back a long ways. Vice President talked about the people in these various offices of soldiers and Marines and sailors and all of them. They have their heritage. They have their veterans. We have ours. We have our veterans. And a people who came before us, people who blazed a path, people who lived a life that became an example to us. Veterans of God's war. Hebrews 11, they're listed here. Not all of them, of course, but some of them are listed here in Hebrews 11. It's gone on for century after century after century, a fight of the same war. And there's heroes from this war, decorated heroes, and their example stands out for us. And we can learn from it, can't we? Because they've already been there. They fought the war, Hebrews 11 and verse 4. By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, and God testifying of his gifts, and by it, he being dead, yet speaks. Well, who does he speak to? Speaking to you, isn't he? Right now, in the pages of this Bible, he's got something to say. And what does he have to say to us? Cain and Abel were both God's children, weren't they? They were in the same war together. And personal jealousy got involved and derailed one of them. Cain turned on his brother. Cain was the firstborn of the two. They were born at nearly the same time, but he was still a firstborn. But he would have had a favored position. He should have been the leader in that family, shouldn't he? Yes. Instead, he was haphazard in his obedience to God. And when Abel did the right thing, Cain resented it, didn't he? Sibling rivalry. Abel was eclipsing Cain. That's what was happening here. Now, I wanted you to think about this today. I think Cain would not have killed Abel if this was a first-time event. You understand how this happens? Something was going on all through their childhood and all through that lifetime into adulthood. There was conflict between them, wasn't there? This wouldn't happen just one time. Oh, you did something better than me one time? Would you kill someone over that? No. But I believe something was going on over and over. Remember the case of Joseph. Remember how he did what the father wanted him to do, didn't he? And what happened? The brothers got jealous. And it happened. And it happened, and we had this dream, and then he did something else, and then something else, and they were getting more harsh and more antagonistic until finally they tried to kill him. They didn't kill him. They sold him into slavery. But you understand my point. Look at Cain and Abel. It'd be the same pattern, you see. The sibling rivalry going on and on and on and building to a point where finally that's it. Now I think this was the straw that broke the camel's back for him, and he finally erupted emotionally and killed his brother. I think that's how it worked. I think it's how it had to work. 1 John 3, if you will. There's an enormous lesson here for us who fight God's war today, isn't there? Let me ask you a question. Do you think there's any rivalry in the church today? Yeah, there's rivalry in the church today. Why? Why should there be any rivalry between brethren that are trying to fight in the same war? Now, when we in physical war, in the military, we turn and kill someone else, they call it what? Friendly fire. Brethren, what we do isn't friendly. It's unfriendly fire. That's what we do to one another. 1 John 3. James, Peter, John. In the Church of God today, there's rivalry, and it should not be. 1 John 3 and verse 11. For this is the message that you've heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of that wicked one and slew his brother. And why did he slay him? Because his own works were evil and his brother's righteous. Think about that. Back to Hebrews 11. In modern day warfare, it's friendly fire. Clearly, we are in a war. And clearly, we should never turn on one another. Never strike out. Because they're not in our church. They're not on our team. They don't believe exactly like we do. So therefore, we should attack. You understand my point? Is Cain and Abel, are they speaking to us today? Are we listening? Are we listening? That's the point. We're in a war, and in the war, we don't want to turn on one another. We need to stay together, bind together. Clearly, the war is not with one another. We're to love and support one another. The war is against sin. Hebrews 11, verse 5. By faith, Enoch was translated that he should not see death. And he wasn't found because God translated him. For before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, it's impossible to please him. For he that comes to God must believe that he is, that he's a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. So Enoch walked with God, and of course that just means he followed God. I have this issue with people today that say, well, we want God on our side, and I go, no, 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 we want to be on his side, so we want to walk with him, and so we want to follow him, as it says in John 10, we hear his voice and follow him. Do you think it was easy for Enoch to simply walk with God at this time? Do you think it was easy for him to live God's way? How do you think others looked at him? So I have a point I want to make today. Why was he translated? Because he wasn't translated to heaven. Remember, the scriptures say that no man is ascended into heaven. So what happened to him? What I'm going to do is suggest that he was like Elijah, and that is that he was removed to another place. He went into not the heavens of God's throne, that is Elijah, but he went into the heavens where the clouds are. Let's go to 2 Kings, if you will. Because there's a parallel here about Enoch that I want to bring out. It's worth, I think, dwelling on, thinking about a little bit in this war that we fight. In other words, yeah, 2 Kings 2. So here we have the case where Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind. And it says this in 2 Kings 2 in verse 11. Came to pass as they still went on and talked that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire and parted them both asunder, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. This took place in 848 BC. The mantle fell then on Elisha, and did any of the sons of the prophets, that is, he was a teacher and he had schools and he taught others and he had a school of the sons of the prophets, did Elisha or did any of the sons of the prophets think that he went to heaven? Notice verse 16. And they said unto him, Elisha, behold now, there be with your servant 50 strong men. Let them go and pray, we pray you, and seek your master, lest peradventure the Spirit of the Lord has taken him up and cast him upon some mountain or into some valley. And he said, you shall not send. And so he said, you don't have to go looking for him. You're not going to find him. Okay? So they talked him into looking for Elijah. And they spent 3 days looking for him, and they couldn't find him anywhere. Now remember, Elijah was serving up in Israel to the north, wasn't he? Okay. Let's go to 2 Chronicles 21. Really struggled through this the other day. You know, last night, Pam and I were up so late going over this. There were two kings, Jehoram, one in the north, one in the south, and figuring out who was who and what was taking place was fairly difficult to do for us, But anyway, we finally did it. And that's why I mentioned 848 was when he was translated, or he was taken, was in 848. So anyway, in 2 Chronicles 21, Jehoram was 32 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. This was 851 to 843. And then 2 Chronicles 21, verse 12. Now there came a writing to him from Elijah the prophet, saying, "Thus says the Lord God of David your father, because you have not walked in the ways of Jehoshaphat your father, nor in the ways of Asa the kings of Judah." He was going to punish him, and he was going to have his intestines rot out of his body, is what it says. And then this was in 845 when this happened, and then in 2 Chronicles 21:19. And it came to pass that in the process of time, at the end of 2 years, his bowels fell out by reason of his sickness. So he died of sore diseases, and his people made no burning for him like the burning of his fathers. And this was in 843. So my point in all this complexity, and it's worth it, I probably should have given a whole sermon on this, but my point is this, is that he was taken from Israel 3 years before the letter came to the king now in Judah. So you see the point I'm making here is that he wasn't taken to heaven, which we understand, but here's the reason we know that is because there came a letter in Judah. So my question would be, and many people have wondered this, where did God take him? But you see, the letter came to the king of Judah because the kingdoms had split, and now what I believe, I'm going to speculate now where he went, that he had Elisha was the prophet who ministered to Israel in the north now, right? When Elijah was gone. I'm suggesting he took him down to Judah now so that he would have a prophet in Judah ministering to the king and to the people there. And that's why the letter 3 years later goes to the king of Judah. So I think there's reason to think this, if you could follow this. Anyway, I hope I didn't confuse too many of you. But my point is this. Enoch was relocated in a similar way. Why? The scriptures say so that he wouldn't taste death. Well, anybody who follows God, remember Enoch was like just the chapter before Noah. If you follow God, what happens? You make enemies, don't you? You're flying in the face of other people. And what do we experience? Generally persecution. Do you think his life was threatened? I do. I think he was taken so that he wouldn't face death. Not that he wouldn't experience death sometime, because we all die. My point is, this, God protected Enoch. God worked through history in a similar way with Elijah. And I'm saying today, he will protect us. That's a great lesson, isn't it? If we're in a war, it's dangerous. We make enemies, don't we, at work? We make enemies out in the world because we won't compromise. And so what happens is we experience persecution. My point today is these are examples of men who stood the course. These are people that didn't compromise, and God intervened miraculously to protect them. My question today is, does this apply to you and me? Is this just ancient history? Or, in fact, are you and I going to see something similar? Because you get persecuted in your life right now, don't you? Do you see we're moving God out more and more? This case in Pennsylvania about creationism that took place, they got rid of the whole school board. They're trying to push God right out of the country. And pretty soon, if you're a believer and you stand for something, and now they had another case. Did you hear that one about the kid who was an RA in a college and he was holding Bible studies, and they told him, you can't hold Bible studies in the college. It's going to get so you can't do anything in public. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's going to get so bad that we'll get persecuted more and more. And do you think there's coming a time when our lives won't be threatened? So can we look back at the veterans who fought the war before and see that they held their course? They didn't give up their place. And because of that, they were protected? Let's look at Psalm 91. We've got to not compromise in our battle here. Psalm 91. Enoch walked with God no matter what. Enoch was taken. He was protected, I believe. Psalm 91, I believe, speaks about a principle of those who obey God. He rewards those that diligently seek Him, who believe in Him. So we don't cave in. We stand for the truth. We trust in God, and God will protect us. In Psalm 91 and verse 1. He that dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He's my refuge, my fortress, my God, in Him will I trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings shall you trust. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid for the terror by night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, or the destruction that wastes at noonday. So you have war here and pestilence, the red horse and the, pale horse. Then he says in verse 7, 1,000 shall fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it won't come near you. Only with your eyes shall you behold and see the reward of the wicked. Because you've made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, you've made Him your habitation. And there shall be no evil befall you, neither any plague come near your dwelling. Back to Hebrews 11. That's a very, very powerful verse. But I believe that the people of God down through the ages believed in this. They didn't have that verse, but they knew that God, and they knew that He was good for His word and that He would protect His people. Go back to Hebrews 11. Enoch's faith, to me, was real faith. People today, I think, make a mistake. They think that real faith is believing so intensely that God will give you what you want. I think Enoch's faith is the kind of faith that we believe God so much that we live the way He says to live. That's what faithful means, doesn't it? Filled with faith, a person who is going to do it the way God says to do it, no matter what the circumstances. To me, that's the real faith. And if we have that kind of faith, you think we'll ever lose a battle? Or will God protect us? I think He will protect us. In verse 7 it says this, by faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, and he prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by which he condemned the world and became heir to the righteousness, which is by faith. Again, here's Noah, to me a great veteran in the war. It says he was perfect in his generations, if you remember that. I don't believe that that means that he was a perfect person. Only Jesus Christ is perfect. But he didn't intermarry with the godless. He had nothing to do with those giants, that is, those tyrants that lived in those days. It was a very violent world in that time, and he had nothing to do with it. And I remember reading in some articles, and I remember going to actually to a museum and seeing this, where the archaeologist showed some of the skeletal remains of people during that age. And they said that it was one of the most violent on earth that they had seen. And they showed skeletons where they had holes in their skulls, because people were so violent at that time. And I think that's what it says in the book of Genesis, that they were really a violent people. But he feared, not for his life. He feared God, didn't he? Remember how this, it says, to this man or this woman will I look, who fears me and trembles at my word. That's how it was with him. And as it says, here's God telling him to build an ark, and he's telling him to do it when no one had ever seen a flood. And what did he do? He did what God said, didn't he? Can you imagine that? Can you imagine? I see him as a man against all odds. Can you see Abraham this way? Nobody, he's doing everything the exact opposite of anybody else. And he's doing something that they would think only a madman's doing. And they'd mock him and they'd ridicule him. But he was going to do what God said. Man, doesn't that tell us something? Doesn't that tell us who fight the war? You and I do some things that are a little odd, don't we? Does the world think you're strange because you go to services on Saturday? You keep Jewish holiday? You won't eat what? What difference does that make? You understand how crazy? You got to take this time off, pull your kids out of school right when we're having midterms or whatever. You understand it's all crazy to them. And they ridicule, don't they? And they mock us. And yet God has said to obey His word. And we're in a war. And He's given us the battle strategy and told us to do it. So I think they leave us with a great, great example. So you don't cheat at work. You dress moderately. Makes us odd to the world. Let's go to Peter here. I'm not sure which one yet. Let me look. Yeah, Peter. 1 Peter. 1 Peter 4. I believe that we look odd to the world. I know they were puzzled at me all the years. 27 years in air conditioning. They were puzzled. Couldn't figure you out, you know. But you know, we used to be just like them. We weren't any different than them, were we? We lived like them. We worked like them. We played like them. And then all of a sudden, we did this 180, didn't we? And now we're going in a different direction because we have a whole different goal. And they think, what? You're weird. You're strange. 1 Peter 4, verse 3. For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lasciviousness, lust, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries. We did all of that. I was good at it, as a matter of fact. Wherein they think it's now strange that you run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. Well, they do. They do. They think it's strange. They think that we're weird. But they persecute, they mock, they ridicule, they make it hard on us. And they do that to everybody. But I say this, we have been given an almost seemingly impossible task. But I say again, we can look at these veterans. We can see what they did and we can know God will bring us through like He brought them through. Do you remember the movie Rudy? How many of you here saw that movie? Good. It's worth seeing. This is a fascinating movie. It's an interesting movie as well. Rudiger wanted to play football at Notre Dame. He didn't have the size. He didn't have the money. He frankly didn't have the talent. He was just an average kind of guy. But he had one thing. He had heart. And that movie shows this story. One thing he had was heart. And so Rudy had this vision. He could go to Notre Dame. Everybody laughed at him. His family didn't believe it. They mocked. They ridiculed him. But he wouldn't let go of the vision. And then an accident happened where he worked. And he realized, I've got to go. I've got to pursue it. And he began with a gift of $1,000. He walked on that Notre Dame campus with $1,000, a duffel bag, and a dream. That's all he had. He didn't have anything else going for him. He began his fight against all odds. He didn't have the skills. He couldn't go to Notre Dame. Of course, he had to start at a kind of junior college level and go to get some prep work done. So he went and he just struggled through it, but he wouldn't give up, and he wouldn't give up, and he wouldn't give up. And finally, he applied to Notre Dame. Rejected. Applied to Notre Dame again. Rejected again. Applied to Notre Dame again and was finally accepted. Now he starts school, and he is going to play football. He's not big enough to play football. So he goes to the coaches and asks if he can play. And the coach laughs at him. You can't play. You know what? Look at yourself. Look at these guys. So he keeps badgering him until he lets down and says, okay. And you get the impression that he's going to bring him out there and let him get hit a few times and it's over for him, right? He goes out there and he becomes the meat grinder for these big hulking men. That's all they let him do. All they want is to have someone for these guys to plow into to get their practice at knocking someone down. He goes out day after day after day to practice. And they beat him up every day. And every day he doesn't quit. He gets to sit on the bench. He never gets to play. He goes all through his time at Notre Dame, struggling with the classes, getting beat up every day, bruised and just aching in pain, limping around there. And the guys are going, why do you do this? And he says, because I want to. I believe it. I'm going to play in the game. He never plays. He sits on the bench every game. The last year, the last season, the last game of the season. It's the end. And the team tells the coach, you got to let him play. You got to let him play one game. And he lets him in. Reluctantly, he lets him in for the last play. The kickoff occurs. He somehow miraculously gets the ball. And he runs this thing with all his might. And he makes a touchdown. You know, the team just erupts in cheers for him. And you watching the movie cheer too. He did the impossible and he won because he had heart. He wouldn't quit no matter what. And so I remind us today of this great hero of faith, that in the opposition of doing the impossible, because if you think Rudy going to Notre Dame was hard, imagine building an ark in the middle of the desert and collecting all those animals and everything. You understand, it was an incredible feat. And he did it in the midst of, I believe, great persecution. Proverbs 16 in verse 3 says this, commit to the Lord whatever you do, and your plans will succeed. And that's a great lesson from Noah. He succeeded and saved his family. And then there's Abraham. We have a vision, don't we? It's an impossible dream, I know that. Us becoming like God, us being in the kingdom, it's impossible. No way. You tell people about it. They just laugh in your face, won't they? They laughed in his face. They won't laugh later. Abraham's another great hero of faith. Hebrews 11, verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out not knowing where he went. By faith, he sojourned in a land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which has foundations, and its builder and maker is God. A great father of the faithful is the way it terms him. So Noah, in my mind, a man against all odds. Right? Abraham, a man against all reason. Think about this. He's told to leave his home, doesn't even know where he's to go, and he goes. What an example. Do you remember the centurion in Christ's day? You remember he said, you know, I'm a man under authority. I have authority. I tell someone to go, they go. Do you see it? Do you see it? He saw the Lord as the captain. He saw him as the centurion. And he says, go, I go. I don't question. I don't reason. I don't make excuses. Man, that's an example for us, isn't it? If we want to win the battles, we've got to follow what he says. And trust that he knows what he's doing and that the battle plan's going to work. And if we get in trouble, he'll save us like he did others. Just do it, is the term. Hebrews 11, verse 11. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. It's amazing. A paragon of virtue, Sarah. Think of her, the mother of the faithful women of God down through the ages. An example for all women. She believed God. Here she was, herself incapable, her husband no more capable, and she believed and trusted in God and received the promise. And she was not fearful. This is a beautiful thing to me. She didn't fear in life. Now, there's a lot of things that women have to fear in life, isn't there? How would you men like to marry someone you had to have be in charge of you? And you had to marry a human and do what that human's view was, and the decisions that human made have to apply to you. That's scary, isn't it? And then you have children. And then you have to send them to school. You think women don't have fears today about drugs, about pregnancies, about gangs? Will my child even survive? Look at this woman who believed God, trusted him, and called her husband Lord, and then followed him as he left civilization and went out and lived in tents and sojourned in a strange land. And you kind of see it, well, why are we doing this? You might think, are you sure about this? What a tremendous, courageous woman that she must have been. How many women today who try to show respect for God's roles of the man and woman in marriage, how many of them are mocked by the rest of the world? Because they don't believe that, do they? They don't believe it at all, the roles that God says in the book. And so women get ridiculed if they try to obey God, and they get mocked. She was a courageous woman in her time, and I say the women who follow her, 1 Peter, if you will, 1 Peter 3, are great women of faith. 1 Peter 3 and verse 1. Likewise, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conduct of the wives, while they behold your chaste conversation, that is conduct, coupled with fear, whose adorning, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair and wearing of gold and putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden person of the heart and that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God great price. For after this manner in the old time the holy women also trusted in God and adorned themselves, being in subjection to their husbands, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, as long as you do well and aren't afraid with any amazement. Back to Hebrews 11. Then it moves back to Abraham again. Anyway, you have to admire Sarah for what she did. Abraham offered up Isaac, and this to me is very, very important. Verse 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it is said that in Isaac shall your seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence he also received him in a figure. Think about this for a moment. Abraham offered up his son, his only beloved or begotten son. Means a special relationship. He actually had another son, but this one was the son of promise. It was the thing he loved the most in life, wasn't it? And he gave that up. I say this. I believe this is an example for all of us. I really do, and I want to get your attention if I can for a moment. Are we going to be any different? Remember what Job said? The thing I feared most has come upon me. He lost everything, didn't he? He had a position. He was wealthy. He was respected. He lost his family. He lost everything. And I'm going to suggest something, that every one of us have something we fear in our lives. We fear the loss of status. We fear the loss of health. We fear the loss of our life. We fear the loss of love. We fear the loss of being valued. We fear all kinds of things. And I suggest to you, like Job and like this great man, we have to be tested in that. Because we have to come to a point in our life where the thing we fear most is God. And then the thing that we fear most can come on us. That is the great God. You understand my point? Could Isaac have been an idol to Abraham? Yes. Can we have idols too? Yes. That's my point. Look at this. If we're going to be soldiers in an army, and if we're going to win this war, we have to be willing to jettison anything and everything and put God and put His mission and put that kingdom of God first, don't we? Yes. And this is where Abraham shows us, the father of the faithful. That's the one who started this, humanly speaking, you see, in God's eyes, because of his great faith. And he showed it this way. And I'm suggesting Job had to go through it. You and I have to go through it. Haven't you in your Christian life so far seen where God has kind of taken you to a certain point and he didn't require much, and then all of a sudden we went through a trial and a little bit of us was kind of carved away? Yeah. A little painful, wasn't it? Have to give up something here? And it has to be like that, bit by bit, piece by piece, until there probably is going to be one single thing left standing, whatever yours is, whatever mine is. And we have to give that up. That's why he tested Abraham. He waited. See, Abraham wasn't perfect, was he? He kind of lied a few times to protect himself, saving his skin. But then he got to a point where God said, okay, now I can test him on this. I'm going to take away the thing he loves most. Let's see if he was going to follow me or not. Because we have to love God most. And I don't mean to belabor this, but I want us to understand. Here's the example. Here's the guy that fought the war. Here's the father of the faithful. And this is what we have to be like. It's the only way, as it says. Here's how it works. We've got to put him first. Hebrews 11, in verse 20 and 21. By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come, and by faith Jacob, when he was a dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. And so here it is, these guys prophesying and blessing their children and the posterity, because they believed so much in the mission. They believed so much in what God had said was going to occur that they blessed these people. And it remains to this day, those prophecies ring true for Esau. They ring true for the children of promise to this day. And so it shows the greatness of God. And then in verse 22, by faith Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. Now, I ask us to think about that just for a moment. Can you imagine someone who lived in Egypt almost their whole life, who lived in the palace, had anything they wanted? What's the issue? Don't you think the normal person would kind of identify with Egypt and say, well, this is my home and I have a place here and I'll be dead anyway? Can you look into the mind of this individual and see how much he believed in a kingdom of God, so that he didn't even want his bones in Egypt? You guys are going to leave it. I know it's a type of sin. You're going to leave this system and leave sin behind. You're not leaving my bones there. I want out. Even the bones. That's pretty adamant, isn't it? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had that kind of attitude about coming out of this world? I don't want any part of it. Even if I was wealthy in it. Even if I had control over things. Even if I had the best position in Pharaoh himself, let me out of here. That's the attitude we should have in the war we fight. By faith, in verse 22, Joseph, when he died, made mention, I'm sorry we read that, in 23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw it was a proper child. They were not afraid of the king's commandment. And so the parents of Moses stand as an example of faith, don't they? They didn't fear the state. They didn't fear the civil government. They feared God, and they walked in God's way to the best of their ability at that time, and they loved their child. And there are people today that are parents, and they have to sometimes go against the state in order to obey God. And so there's people today that are going to discipline their children so that those children finally learn self-discipline. And so they take and privately spank their children sometimes because they feel it's necessary. And I believe that. And I've talked to so many people that didn't get disciplined, and they said they found it so hard to control themselves later. Okay? And there's sometimes they have to take them out of school and homeschool them so that they don't become corrupted by this evil world. At least they have to deprogram every day. And so we have parents that are willing to go against the state even today. By faith, Moses, in verse 24, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. And so by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured, as seeing him who was invisible. What a great story. He didn't want to be called the son of the daughter of Pharaoh. He refused it. Do we refuse to be called the daughter of the whore? You understand? We're living in a system that's like Egypt today. And do we want to be called this, a citizen of this city or that country? You see the point I make? This is a modern-day Babylon, and she has influenced our culture and our age, hasn't she? And our religions. Do we refuse to be even named by that name. And then think about this. A man who had the wealth, power, and status that he had in Pharaoh's court. And he said he would rather have Christ correct him than have these pleasures. I'd rather be punished by God than have the fun over here. He really saw it, didn't he? He saw where God was coming from, and he saw the value in God's way. That's an amazing statement to me. He believed God, and so he forsook Egypt, and he left Egypt behind. By faith they passed through, in verse 29, the Red Sea, as by dry land, where the Egyptians, attempting to do so, were drowned. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down, and they were compassed about 7 days. Isn't it amazing? Here he faithfully acted out events that would foreshadow the end times. They went through a Red Sea, and the sea opened, and the sea closed on the Egyptian army that was pursuing them. And that foreshadows something that we will go through very likely in the end times, doesn't it? When an army's pursuing the church of God and the earth opens up and closes over them. And then, blowing seven trumpets and the walls of Jericho fall down. Isn't that like the seventh trump happens and then Babylon is fallen? Yes. That was the seat there of a wicked government. And then the people of Joshua would go in and fight a holy war to clean out all of the idols and anything that was against God. Then the scriptures list a host of other veterans in our war that did great exploits in verse 31. We're getting close to the end here. By faith, the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace. And what shall I say more of the time would tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms. They wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, and out of weakness were made strong, and waxed valiant in fight, and they turned to flight the armies of the aliens, and women received their dead raised to life again. Amazing exploits. Well, do you think we're not going to do that too? Do you really think not? Because what's it say in Daniel? They will do great exploits, won't they, at the very end. God's people are going to be empowered again if we're faithful, if we believe in it, and if we see it as the war that it is. We're going to do exploits. Believe in it. But on the other hand, look what it says. And others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others had trial of cruel mockings and scourging, yes, moreover of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, sawn asunder. If we go into the end time and it doesn't work out that we do great exploits or we aren't somehow protected, but we can stand for God like these individuals have, we've done an honorable and wonderful act in the name of the kingdom, haven't we? It is a glory to us to do so. So don't fear that. Don't fear suffering. As it says, be willing to suffer. Endure hardship as a good soldier. And then it says this, all these have obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. Why? Because God provided something better for us. Man, let me stop for a minute. They received not the promise. So what about Enoch and Elijah and those guys? See the point? Enoch did not go to heaven. He hasn't received any promise yet. He has not received the kingdom, anything like that. He hasn't. He is waiting in his grave. God provided something better for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. So they're waiting for us. And I always say, when I read this scripture, they're waiting for us. What are we waiting for, you see? We're in a war against sin, against injustice, against pride and vanity, against all falsehoods. It's against the pulls of the world, against Satan, the devil's influence, and it's against our own selves and our own human nature. And to me, Hebrews 11 summarizes these lives of a few of these great heroes and heroines of faith. They are the veterans in God's war. And there are lessons there for us, lessons that we can learn from and we should learn from. And then it says this, it concludes in chapter 12, "Wherefore, seeing we're compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, all of these people that went before us, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us." We've got to run the race. We've got to fight an uphill battle. We've got to do the impossible. And so it says, lay aside every weight. Lay aside the thing you think you have to have. Lay aside, put down the walls, as it were, that keep us from God. Put them down. Lay aside the fighting with our husbands, as it were. Lay aside the need to be accepted by others. Lay aside the fears of what others might be able to do to us. What they might expect from us. Lay aside any allegiance we have to anything else. And go forward remembering these great heroes. And remember the great hero of faith. The first veteran. The captain of our salvation. And what he went through, because it says he blazed a trail for us. That's what the captain means. It's a pioneer, a trailblazer, the one that goes before. And he made the path like the great pioneers did so that others could follow coming west in America. And so we're going to follow in his steps. So seek then those things that the veterans in the past have sought for. You know, when Veterans Day comes, we hardly think about it, I believe. But I'm going to ask you today, maybe the sermon wasn't a blockbuster, but I'd like to leave an impression. When Veterans Day comes next time, think about Jesus Christ as a veteran. Think about those heroes in Hebrews 11 that went before us. And think about some of the lessons they left us. And recommit ourselves on Veterans Day to seeking first the kingdom of God and His righteousness.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.